From KTOO in Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea with this news. Ballots in Juneau's local election this fall won't have questions about a proposed sales tax break on groceries. There have been months of discussion and debate on the topic at Juneau Assembly meetings. Now the Assembly wants to wrap it up with a public opinion poll instead of asking voters directly on the ballot. At the beginning of June, the Assembly was leaning toward getting the public's opinion through advisory questions on the ballot. Advisory questions don't become law if they are passed by voters. They just help inform city officials. The questions would have paired the tax break with different options for new taxes to recoup most of the costs to the city. But by the end of June, most Assembly members had become concerned about how those non-binding questions would look alongside separate tax-related questions that will be on the ballot that are binding. Deputy Mayor Maria Gladyszewski.
These ballot questions, I think, would be super just confusing. And then if the sales tax things pass, then we'd have to do it again and people would have to vote on it twice. And then they'd be like, didn't I vote on this last time?
The city charter doesn't allow the Assembly to change the sales tax rate, so voters would have to approve it with another ballot question in another election. Assembly member Wade Bryson was also concerned that adding the advisory questions could confuse voters on three other ballot questions in the works that deal with funding major city projects. That includes funding to build a new city hall.
Man, I really had my heart set on removing sales tax with this assembly, but I'm afraid if we tried to squeeze it into this ballot, this October's ballot, that it could have more harm than good.
Gladyszewski suggested an alternative.
You know, so I'm wondering if we could achieve our same objectives by just hiring a firm to do a statistically valid survey.
Most of the other assembly members were amenable. A measure to spend up to $40,000 for the survey is set for a public hearing and a final vote at the assembly's next regular meeting on August 1st. The timing for the survey isn't set. City Manager Rory Watt told the assembly he wants to avoid election season. A new study shows that mines can have impacts on watersheds hundreds of miles downstream and years into the future. As KSTK's Sage Schmiley reports, the paper's authors say their analysis points to a need for more comprehensive risk consideration for mines in order to protect salmon watersheds throughout the Northwest.
There are thousands of coal and metal mines, both active and inactive, scattered throughout northwestern North America. A study published earlier this month in the journal Science Advances found a consistent pattern of harm to salmon habitat and watersheds from some of those mines.
It's basically a smoking gun.
Guy Archibald is the executive director of the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission, a coalition of 15 tribal governments advocating for protections for watersheds shared by Alaska and British Columbia and Canada, as well as tribal representation in the decision-making process for BC mines. He says the study is groundbreaking.
We have observed for decades that mines and watersheds occur and then salmon populations are harmed. But there's never been a direct connection made between the mining activities and the harm to salmon. And this paper goes a long ways to showing that.
Jonathan Moore is a co-author of this study and a salmon ecosystem scientist and professor at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia.
I think that's one of the things that's really unique about this paper is it does bring together the sort of state-of-the-art science about how these really complicated and changing river systems work with sort of state-of-the-art sort of mining understanding and how it's regulated.
Moore says the paper isn't arguing against mining.
What it is it's arguing for the incorporation of best available science to guide mining so it can be most sustainable.
The study's lead author, Chris Sargent, is a research scientist with the University of Montana's Flathead Lake Biological Station. Sargent says there's no one-stop shop for mining data, so they had to pull from a variety of sources: U.S. Geological Survey databases, data from mining industry resources, government agencies, and academic literature. In that data, study authors found numerous examples of mines having negative impacts on watersheds, even long after they were closed.
For instance, we point out a river in the Coeur d'Alene watershed in Idaho, where even 70 years after mining had ended, the pollution that maintained because of that work continues to depress the populations of fish and aquatic insects in that stretch of river.
It can be a similar story hundreds of miles away from mines and across international borders.
In the Elk Valley watershed in southern BC that flows in the Kootenai River and through Montana and Idaho back into BC, there's selenium pollution from coal mines that's 250 kilometers downstream. And that wasn't really envisioned before those mines were built.
The U.S. government is taking note. Last month, the Biden administration called on the Canadian government to participate in a joint investigation of that selenium pollution in the Transboundary Elk Valley watershed. In 2020, Congress committed millions of dollars to transboundary watershed monitoring projects. Whether or not mines or watersheds straddle borders, Sargent also notes mines are being proposed and built in more and more extreme environments, on mountains, across glaciers, as easy-to-reach areas are already tapped.
So you've got these feats of engineering to build mines in places where there are no roads or many humans at all. And then on top of that, you've got climate change coming down the pike where we're getting more intense rain events, more landslides, more flooding, more drought.
Sargent says a prime example of unforeseen climate impacts is the Red Dog Mine in western Alaska, which was built in 1989.
Because of unforeseen permafrost thaw, their water treatment facilities and their open pits are getting overwhelmed with more water than we've ever envisioned. And that's within a few decades of the project starting. So those are the kind of concerns I see. Is like, can we, if we're building these bigger and bigger mine projects, can we even do the engineering correctly?
He points out that mines are critical for the transition to a low-carbon future. Copper and other minerals are essential parts of batteries for electric cars and other low-carbon alternatives.
The decision to build a large mine is going to impact the land for decades to centuries, and that decision needs to be thought about really carefully.
For study authors, the data point to a need for better transparency, more consideration of the cumulative effects of mines, and the complex environmental stressors that could impact mines and watersheds due to the changing climate. For Archibald and the Tribal Coalition, the study is clear evidence that the BC government should take into account a much wider swath of possible impacts when permitting mines.
Well, if they don't talk to the downstream communities, if they don't learn how these communities utilize the resource and depend on the resource, then basically they're making a decision without any information. And that's no way to manage a mine and a habitat.
Mining Association of BC, a mining industry group, did not respond to a request for comment. In Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
Yesterday, state health officials reported 147 new cases of COVID-19 for Juneau from the last week. That number does not include any positive results from home tests. It does include 19 non-resident cases. Statewide, there were more than 4,400 new cases reported, including 491 non-resident cases reported from vessels at sea. All but one of them are tourism-related. 23 new deaths related to the virus were reported for Alaska. These are not necessarily recent deaths. They occurred this year, but were reported to the state after a batch of death certificate reviews. There are 67 patients with COVID-19 in Alaska's hospitals. One is on a ventilator. At-home COVID tests are available at Juneau's libraries, City Hall, the Police Department, and Juneau Public Health Center. COVID-19 vaccinations are available for anyone 6 months or older. Juneau Public Health offers vaccine clinics on Wednesdays and Fridays. In Juneau, call 907-586-6000 or go to juneau.org/vaccine to make an appointment. Kodiak saw its first cruise ship in more than 2 years today. KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth reports it marks the start of the island's first cruise ship season since before the pandemic.
More than 500 passengers will be on board the Roald Amundsen when she docks at Pier 2 in Kodiak this week, the first time the island has seen cruise ship tourism since 2019. Amy Williams is the executive director of the Visitors Bureau Discover Kodiak.
This is a good sign that life is turning back to normal and that tourism is returning back to normal.
Kodiak's cruise ship season tends to look a little different compared to other parts of the state, according to Williams. The ships tend to be smaller than the ones that frequent Southeast Alaska, and there's a lot less of them. 30 large and small cruise ships called in Kodiak back in 2019. That was a record year. This year, just 10 cruise ships will visit the island. Williams says that while cruise ship tourism gives Kodiak businesses a boost, its downtown was spared from some of the economic hardships faced by other coastal communities when COVID stopped the cruises from coming.
When they weren't here for the last 2 years, we weren't devastated and we didn't lose businesses because cruise ships weren't in town. So I think the same thing is when they come back, it's exciting and those businesses that are going to make money, I'm sure, are very excited. But we don't have to change our posture a lot for when there's a cruise ship here or when there's not.
The Roald Amundsen will continue on to Dutch Harbor after she stops in Kodiak this week, and it will visit twice again in August. Six cruise ships will call in Kodiak throughout September, including the New Amsterdam, which has a carrying capacity of more than 2,000 passengers.
When those big ships come, anything that's over like 900 people kind of has to change the way we do business downtown.
Kodiak's cruise ship season wraps up in early October, when the nearly 700-passenger regatta calls in Kodiak on her voyage from Los Angeles to Tokyo. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
An investigation has been launched after a person believed to be an Anchorage police officer was shown in a photo with a woman in town for a Donald Trump rally, flashing a novelty white privilege card. Social media posts caused concerns about racial equality in Alaska's largest city. The woman claimed she had just arrived for Saturday's rally when police stopped her for weaving. She couldn't find her license, but gave the officers her white privilege card. She claims she was not ticketed. Alaskans will soon be able to reach a suicide prevention hotline by calling a three-digit number. Starting Saturday, calls and texts to 988 from a 907 area code will go to the CareLine, Alaska's suicide hotline. And it's part of a national effort to establish one suicide hotline number across the country. Alaskans will still be able to reach the CareLine at 877-266-HELP. The number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-TALK. And finally, let's take a look at the National Weather Service forecast for the Juneau area. Tonight, cloudy, isolated rain showers, lows around 50, light winds. And that is it for the KTOO News Update for Thursday, July 14th, 2022. I'm Jeremy Shea. Thanks for listening.